Subcommittee on Legislative Process Reform. And the first item on the agenda, we're going to just skip the approval of the minutes for now and move to the presentation by nonpartisan staff, the role of the nonpartisan chief clerk's office, its structure and duties in the Minnesota House. So if we would have the chief clerk and whoever else he wishes to bring up, address the committee, and please, welcome to the committee, please identify yourself for the record.
Chair Pawlowski, members of the Subcommittee on Legislative Process Reform, my name is Pat Murphy, and I'm the chief clerk of the Minnesota House. I've been asked today to talk to you about the nonpartisan chief clerk's office, its structure and duties in the Minnesota House. I'm not here today to advocate for any particular legislative process reform. That is clearly not my role. I'm a nonpartisan administrator, and you members are the elected decision makers. It would not be prudent or professional for me to advocate for any particular reform here today. However, I am here to talk about our office, the nonpartisan chief clerk's office, and the role it plays in the lawmaking process. We in the chief clerk's office are a committed and dedicated team of close to 30 nonpartisan professionals who take our roles in the legislative process very seriously. The chief clerk is elected every 2 years, and I'm honored and humbled to serve as the chief clerk of the Minnesota House. I'm proud to say that I've been elected many times to my position as either chief clerk of the House or first assistant chief clerk of the House with the support of DFL majorities and Republican majorities and back and forth a number of times in my career. I have 99 peers around the country, and I'm proud to say that, frankly, only a handful of us are truly nonpartisan. Being elected chief clerk of the House is a privilege and an honor, and I take this responsibility very serious as someone who believes in the process and someone who values and respects the Minnesota House as an institution. I want to thank you and all the members of the House for this privilege, and I want you to know how grateful I am the opportunity to serve as the chief clerk of the House. Like I said, the position of the chief clerk is elected by the members every 2 years. This is my 41st session. Yes, I've been here 41 years. Not quite as long as Representative Carlson or Representative Murphy, but right behind them. I've seen a lot of changes in how the legislature operates in my career. I started in 1978 as a page. I've been through 12 different party changes in my career, and I have worked for 16 different speakers. But there are two things I never forget, and I'm constantly reminding our staff. The work we do here at the Capitol is important. It matters to the people of Minnesota. And never forget that it is an honor and a privilege to work in the Capitol building. I tell this to new members, to new staff all the time. Every time I come to work and walk in the building, I say to myself, how lucky I am to work here in one of the most beautiful buildings in our country. What role does the chief clerk and the chief clerk's office play in the legislative process? First off, the institutional role of the office of the chief clerk and the office of the secretary of the Senate in American legislative bodies in this country dates back well over 300 years. Originally, the role was established under the English parliamentary system to serve functions like record keeping, bill processing that are basic and critical to the lawmaking process. The office of the legislative clerk or secretary is the oldest staff arm of American state legislatures. For instance, in 1619, the Virginia House of Burgess was assisted as they organized their first session by a clerk from the British House of Commons. It may interest you to know that the terms of office for British and Canadian clerks differ from American clerks and secretaries. Clerks of the British and Canadian parliaments are appointed for life. I'm not here to advocate that, but I just thought that was interesting to say the least. In the United States, most clerks and secretaries are elected or appointed by their respective bodies to 2 or 4 year terms. In Minnesota, there's been a person elected to be chief clerk since 1858. In fact, our office is planning to celebrate next year our 162nd year as an office. So that's quite a festive event for us. And I'm not counting the 9 years from 1849 to 1857 when there was a chief clerk for the territorial legislature. The Chief Clerk's Office supervises and performs many of the administrative functions of the lawmaking process. The Chief Clerk serves as the parliamentary advisor to the Speaker, to members, and to staff. Our office is a resource center providing information on the legislative process to members, staff, and the public. The duties of the Chief Clerk are spelled out in Rule 710. Rule 710, duties of the Chief Clerk, reads as follows, and I quote, "The Chief Clerk has general supervision of all clerical duties pertaining to the business of the House. The Chief Clerk must perform, under the direction of the Speaker, all the duties of the Office of the Chief Clerk. The Chief Clerk must keep records showing the status and progress of bills, memorials, and resolution. The Chief Clerk must supervise the engrossment and enrollment of bills. The Chief Clerk must see that a record is kept by file number of the bills introduced in the House that passed both houses and are enrolled." End of quote. Or as a young kid in the gallery one day said, as he pointed to us clerks preparing for session, he said, "Those are the people that make sure those other people who sit at those little desks do what they're supposed to do and that no one forgets." Well, that's a pretty good description of what we do in the clerk's office. We keep track of all legislative action. We publish what they do in the official legal record, the Journal of the House. Article 4, Section 15 of the Minnesota Constitution and Minnesota Statutes, Section 3.17, require that the Chief Clerk's Office publish a daily and permanent journal which documents all official House action on bills from their introduction to enactment into law. We are responsible for ensuring that all House action properly complies with the procedural mandates and requirements outlined in the Minnesota Constitution, Minnesota law, House rules, and joint rules of the House and Senate. In Minnesota, the Journal of the House is the official legal record of all House action. Our journal is not a word-for-word transcript of House sessions. However, it is a record of what is done rather than what is said. The Journal of the House contains the chronology of a bill from its introduction to its passage. The Journal of the House is structured around our daily order of business as set forth in our House rules. The journal contains bill introductions, committee reports, messages from the Senate, veto messages, communications from the governor and the secretary of state, conference committee reports, motions, points of order, rulings, precedents, amendments, and all recorded roll call votes taken in the House. The courts in Minnesota have ruled that Minnesota is a journal entry state under which the journals of the House and Senate may be examined as evidence that the legislature properly complied with the constitutional requirements in the enactment of the law. Our daily and permanent journals are published in-house using applications developed by our IT department. Posting and publishing the House journal is no small task. The journal, frankly, is the foundation of the bill status system. In 2017-2018 regular and 2017 special session, the journal consists of 11 volumes and 11,860 pages. In 2019 regular and 2019 special session, the Journal of the House consists of 6 volumes and 6,184 pages. Our office, as well as our friends up in the Legislative Reference Library, has journals dating back to 1858 through 2019. Our office works closely with the reviser of statutes and helps oversee the engrossment of a bill as it moves through the process. When a bill is amended, either on the House floor or in committee, we work with staff from the reviser's office to ensure that each amendment is properly incorporated into subsequent engrossments of the bill. In addition, we publish the daily calendars, floor amendments. We also maintain a comprehensive index of all bills working their way through the legislative process according to bill number, topic, and author. I'd like to take a moment today to say a special thanks here to the reviser of statutes, Ryan Inman, and his office, and to the attorneys in the reviser's office, the deck staff in the reviser's office, and the reviser's IT staff for all the tremendous support they give all of us here in the House. I also want to point out that the Chief Clerk's Office is one of many departments in the House that makes this place run. I want to publicly acknowledge and thank all the other House departments for all they do to make this place work. I want to thank leadership and their staffs from the three caucuses. I want to thank all you members. And I want to thank Pat McCormick and the House Research staff, Bill Marks and the House Fiscal staff, Bob Meyerson and the Sergeant-at-Arms staff, Barry LaGrave and the House Public Information staff, Kelly Knight and the Human Resources staff, Barb Julek and the Budget and Accounting staff. It takes all of our departments to make this place work. Another key role the Chief Clerk's office, as well as the other nonpartisan offices, play is that we all provide continuity and stability for the House as an institution, especially during a transition or change in leadership power after an election. In Minnesota, House members run for a two-year term, meaning they face election or re-election every 2 years. To illustrate my point about the House nonpartisan offices providing continuity and stability for the House as an institution, let me just review this with you. Let's look at the last election cycles over the last 10 years, 2008 to 2018. Think about this. In 2008, the House had 87 Democrats, 47 Republicans. 2 years later, 2010, 72 Republicans, 62 Democrats. 2012, it went back 73 Democrats, 61 Republicans. 2014, 72 Republicans, 62 Democrats. That's amazing. Four elections, four transitions. We went from Democrat to Republican to Democrat to Republican, as most of you and many of you recall. 2016, 77 Republicans, 57 Democrats. Republicans kept power. 2018, 75 Democrats, 59 Republicans. So the last six election cycles, there have been five transitions. I feel compelled to point that out because that's crucial to the role of many of the offices around here. One of the responsibilities of the Chief Clerk's office is to provide training in parliamentary procedure and the legislative process to House leadership, members, and new staff. During a leadership turnover, there are numerous classes and training sessions conducted by our office to help new leadership and new staff smoothly assume their roles. For example, last fall and into January after election, I taught at least 15 different classes to new members, new leadership, new staff, including a number of mock sessions in the House chamber. Our office, with the support of the Revisor's Office, also maintains and manages the House website and bill tracking system. We track legislative action in real time, meaning we update the bill status system as actions occur on the House floor. Additionally, our office is responsible for the management of information technology, the development, design, and maintenance of the House website, which includes posting information on the House bill status system or bill tracking system. Now, during session, our office divides the day into three parts. Pre-session work, or the work that we need to do to prepare for each daily session when the members arrive at 3:30 or what have you. For example, every day, Dacia Hinkhouse, the administrative assistant to the chief clerk, and myself prepare a daily script for leadership for the upcoming floor session. Then there is part two of our day, the actual floor session. And of course, depending on the day, this can be rather long. I know you all know that. Point three, post-session work, or the work we need to do to wrap up that day's session work before we go home. Now I want to talk about the duties and functions of our office and how each department in the Chief Clerk's office plays a key role in our operation. First, the folks you see most often are the House desk staff in the House chamber. House desk staff ensures that the House business is carried out in accordance with the Constitution of the State of Minnesota, the permanent rules, and all other rules and laws that relate to legislative operation and the enactment of laws. Staff organizes the order of business, prepares motions, organizes and distributes floor amendments, as well as members' handouts. We also record all roll call votes, answer parliamentary questions, edit the Journal of the House, and offer advice regarding procedure. So you may ask yourself, as you look down on the floor of the House, what are those people at the desk doing? Well, I'll try to explain. We are keeping track of what's going on the House floor. No small task. Things we have to keep in mind are, what order of business are we under? What bill are we debating? What amendment are we on? Or what amendment to amendment are we on? Who raised that point of order? What rule are they citing? Helping unravel a point of parliamentary inquiry. Who just made that motion? How many votes does that require? Which member has the floor? What bill is coming up next? What happened to House File 42 that we debated a couple of hours ago? How did I or this member vote on a bill or amendment the other day? And so on and so on. And it comes at you very hot and heavy, to say the least, out there on the House floor. Paper flow at the desk. So this is part and parcel to what those folks are doing and all the shuffling of documents at the desk. Paperwork starts down at the west end of the desk with David Serdez, the legislative clerk, and Mary Lee Davis, the desk clerk, and Kathy Carlson, the desk assistant, all of people who most of you know. Each order of business is prepared down at that end of the desk and then set up on the speaker's desk. Our staff also administer and manage the pre-filing of the amendment process, update the amendment status on the amendment screen webpage in real time during session. So if amendment is adopted or not adopted, we post that information immediately on the amendment page for members and the public. Then each order of business, bill, amendment, motion, or action is handed by the speaker to the chief clerk, who formally then reports the business to the House. The paperwork flows to the other side, or the east end of the desk, where First Assistant Chief Clerk Tim Johnson compiles, edits, and writes the Journal of the House with the support of Gail Romanowski, the Second Assistant Chief Clerk, and our Third Floor Documents Division staff. The Journal is the publication of the entire Chief Clerk's office, working as a team under some very stressful conditions. I'm proud to say this. Our journal is posted on the House website usually within an hour after daily adjournment. No other state turns their journal around this quickly. Most other states post their journal the next morning. This is a high priority for our office. We take great pride in this accomplishment. Deadlines, yes. We must compile, edit, proof, and audit the daily journal every session day and post it on the House website before we leave each night. We must complete this job and many other tasks before we go home each night, whatever it takes. Usually this means our staff goes home about 2 hours after everyone else leaves and session adjourns. Now I just want to talk a little bit about the various departments and duties of various departments in our office. The duties of the front office department, led by Paul Hicks and his staff. Paul is not here today. He's recovering from surgery. So, Paul, hurry back. We miss you. The chief clerk's front office, or room 211 to most of you, is the place where the public, legislators, and staff go to receive copies of legislation, calendars, journals, chapters, and other legislative documents. They respond to many inquiries at a public counter and by telephone regarding the status of legislation, legislative procedure, how to contact one's legislator, and general questions about the House and state government. As the only House office located in the Capitol, our front office staff understands and they often represent a first point of contact for the public to many Minnesotans with the Minnesota House. Accordingly, they take pride in offering a positive interaction with the public and provide helpful information at all times. The front office also maintains and archives documents for the House of Representatives in our Capitol storage facilities. Our staff can pretty much locate any bill ever due in the entire history of the state of Minnesota. Next, there is the Floor Proceedings Administrative Support Third Floor Department, led by Stephanie Miller and her staff. Yes, they're the ones behind the statuary work on the third floor in the chamber there. It's that office is connected to the House floor by a pneumatic tube, a source of curiosity for many people as they see us constantly putting documents, sending them up to the pneumatic tube to our third floor support staff. This staff is responsible for the creation, production, duplication, and posting on our website of all documents necessary to conduct session. Documents related to the order of business, such as things that you're all familiar with, comparison reports, committee reports, bill introductions, message of the Senate, first reading of Senate bills, motions, author changes, and more are all compiled and proofed prior to session. Doing so requires interaction with the House and Senate desks, leadership staff, and members. in an effort to ensure bills are sent to the correct committees, proper procedures are followed, and that the Senate by message is informed of every House action. Once compiled, the documents are posted to the House website. Some are printed in-house and made ready for distribution on the floor and to the public in our front office. A duplicating room adjacent to the House chamber is critically important on these days when the Chief Clerk's office staff is tasked with processing large amounts of information. Additionally, it allows the House to operate quickly as everything from members' handouts to amendments and other documents sometimes are requested to be printed out at a moment's notice. Each year, the largest and longest duplicating job is the Journal of the House. Each daily journal is electronically compiled, formatted by staff, and posted on our website. During the interim, the entire department spends much of its time proofing, auditing, and preparing the journal for final publication. Permanent journals are printed in-house before being sent out to a binding contractor, allowing the Chief Clerk's office to exercise a great deal of control over this constitutionally mandated document. The floor proceedings administrative support staff have a hand in a number of other areas as well. All House file bill histories, all the bill histories you see on the bills that you access on the internet, that the people up there put those bill histories together and they update them as bills move around through the legislative process. We're responsible for posting these floor documents online as well as they support us in monitoring the pre-filed amendment process on the floor. Next, we have our House Index Department, led by Carl Hamry and his staff. Pursuant to House Rule 710, the index clerk maintains a record of bills as part of the Chief Clerk's office duties. All bills introduced in the House are indexed by close to 200 different subject areas, by bill number, by author, by statutory citation, by committee, division action, and by any additional ways that can be helpful to members, staff, and the general public. This information is maintained online in our bill status system, which is commonly referred to as a bill tracking system. The information is updated in real time as committees in the full House act on bills. Anyone with internet access has access to all this information through the House website. The House Index Office is always available to assist both members and the public in all types of bill research and bill tracking inquiries by telephone. Subsequent to adjournment, these indexes are compiled and published in a hard copy as a permanent index to the House Journal. This allows people to research and access the journal regardless of future technologies. Then there's the Communication Officer, House Electrician, or Joe Hensey. Communication Officer maintains, upgrades, and supports the electronic voting system in the House chamber. He is also responsible for all the sound, microphones, recording, and communication equipment in the House chamber and House committee rooms to meet and service the needs of House members, staff, and the public. Then there's the Information Technology Department led by Mike Spiker and his staff. The IT department staff provides the planning and project management for all House computer systems. Chief Clerk's Office IT staff provides support for computer systems and related hardware, not only to the Chief Clerk's Office, but also programming support and expertise to all the other IT departments in the House. Development and management of the House website is also maintained by the Chief Clerk's Office IT staff. One of the great challenges and honors of my career here at the Capitol was being heavily involved in the Capitol Restoration Project. Our office has been involved in this project for the last 7 years. We have attended dozens of workshops, meetings with the project manager, consulting team, the team of architects, the general contractor, dozens of other contractors and subcontractors. I've personally been involved in this project for all 7 years with four different speakers, two Republican and two Democrat. That had its own unique set of challenges with different priorities, with different leadership teams. Our staff knows the pressures and stresses of constantly dealing with a major challenge of working with and around the Capitol Restoration Project. We were actually displaced as an office for about a year and a half, and we were located in the basement of the state office building. We were even challenged in June of 2015, as a lot of you probably remember, when the governor called us into special session and the Capitol was closed. So they came to us, and we had to create, invent, and replicate the House chamber in room 10 of the state office building. How many of you remember that pleasant experience of meeting in room 10 of the SOB for close to 18 hours? Well, that certainly was an interesting and challenging time for us, having to call all the roll orally, et cetera. I think there were 18, 19, 20-some roll calls. But I think it was Representative Davids that came up to me and said, hey, Pat, this is great. This really looks great. But it's a little tight out here in the seating arrangement. He said, it reminds me of flying in an airplane, but you don't get the peanuts. Even though the Capitol Restoration Project is done, well, we still have a punch list of items that we are following up on. We still continue to go to meetings that require our due diligence and follow through on behalf of leadership and the Minnesota House to ensure all our interests in these projects are successfully completed. But like I said, being able to play a key role in the Capitol Restoration Project on behalf of the Minnesota House of Representatives is one of the great honors and experiences of my career as a St. Paul kid who grew up about a mile from here, so the Capitol's always been a big part of my life. In addition, some of the other duties and function of the chief clerk's staff include running dozens of mock sessions in the House chamber for members and their numerous school groups. As I look around the members in here, I know most of you have availed yourself to that opportunity, and we and our staff love being there to help you run those. We also have held legislative procedure classes in the House chamber to new members, to pages, to interns, political science classes, law school classes, and other various public groups. Our staff is always available on a moment's notice to the members to lead small guided tours and on-the-spot presentation to the dozens of small groups that frequently come into the chamber. This is all under the purview of public relations and public outreach for the Minnesota House. Our office and staff are also very involved in the Youth and Government Program, where over 1,500 students in the first weekend of January every year take complete control of the Capitol, the Judicial Center, and the State Office Building. Our office also plays a major role in the Girls State Mock Session every June in the House Chamber. In 2017, the Chief Clerk's Office introduced and kind of launched a new public relations and public outreach program on behalf of the Minnesota House. We now have one of our staff people at the front door in the House chamber every weekday from 9 to 4 to welcome and greet public visitors to the House chamber. We've created a system whereby each of our employees take rotating shifts at the front door. We've set up together a list of expectations for working the front door and fun facts about the House chamber to share with folks. As part of this effort, our office assists the public in understanding the role the House plays in the legislative process and its functions. I strongly believe that this is a very important new public outreach and public relations venture for the entire Minnesota House. We've received hundreds of positive comments from visitors, not just from Minnesota, but from all over the world, who come, and they're so honored that we actually have a human being at the front door to welcome them to the Minnesota House. Typically, a lot of Minnesotans want to know who is their state legislator, and we're very happy to be able to access that information and point out where each of you sit, depending on where they come from. Our office believes this has a huge institutional value, and I believe it changes the public's attitude towards the legislature in a very positive and constructive way. It helps to demystify the legislature and put a human face on it when members of the public can walk in and actually see and talk to someone. I'm often asked the following questions. What is the number one comment you hear from members during session about the process? Well, in the final 3 or 4 days of session, one of the comments our staff hear most often from members is, we don't have enough time to read these conference reports before we vote on them. Our observation is, currently joint rules require conference reports to be posted online and available to members 12 hours before action on the report. But the rule does not apply after the last Thursday of a session. So the last 4 days of a session, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, the 12-hour rule is not in effect. This rule could be changed or altered to keep the 12-hour rule in place up to adjournment. The body would still have the option with 90 votes to suspend the 12-hour rule and take up a conference report if it so chooses. This change would require the body to have bills out of conference earlier, but it would give members, more importantly the public, more time to read and caucus reports before voting on them. Chair Pawlowski, members of the Subcommittee on Legislative Process Reform, my observation about the House rules is that they have served this institution extremely well over the years. The majority of our rules, in fact, most of our rules, have been in place 70, 80 years or longer. What I mean to say is that they have been road tested or battle tested, if you will. They have stood the test of time, and that is very important when you put new rules in place. When I am asked by members about new rules or proposed changes, I generally advise or lightly suggest the following thoughts. Never do by rule what you can do by conversation. Sometimes it's better to talk these things out. We don't necessarily have to put it in the rules, meaning you can't put everything into the rules. Our rules are currently 36 pages long. If you put everything into the rules that people talk about, they would be a few hundred pages long, and that would render them nearly useless. As I would point out, I have friends all over the country, and my friends in Texas have rules 280 pages long, and they talk about all the time about how, frankly, useless their rules are. It's a little overkill. Rules vary from state to state. I have the rules here from South Dakota. They're 6 pages. Not advocating anything like that, but our rules are 36 pages. Just for instance, California, 47 pages. Colorado, 38 pages. Iowa, 20 pages. Michigan, 22 pages. New Jersey, 31 pages. New York, 22 pages. Virginia, 22 pages. I could go on and on, but there is some wisdom in keeping your rules at a certain length. I would also keep in mind this thought as well. You can't write the perfect rule. Trust me on this. There are always exceptions and what ifs. Like I said, you can't write the perfect rule. Why do I say that? Because once you write a new rule, there are members, trust me on this, that immediately will try to figure a way around the rule. I know. I get these kind of calls. Well, the rule doesn't say I can't do this. That's to my point about stability, continuity, and value and battle testing of the rules that we have. In writing rules, as in writing laws, there is the rule of unintended consequences. So be careful, be prudent, be practical, think things through before making big changes. Finally, sometimes the issue isn't that we need a rule to change something. Sometimes we just need to change legislative behavior. In closing today, I want to share with you something that we in the Chief Clerk's office wrote back in the mid-90s. It is the Minnesota House of Representatives Chief Clerk Code of Conduct. There is a copy of this in your packet. These are the expectations we in our office lay out for our staff when they are hired. I just want to walk through this quickly, the Chief Clerk's Code of Conduct, as you can see there. Quoting from our Code of Conduct, it is a privilege to serve the legislature and the people of Minnesota. Recognizing the importance of staff to the main mission of the Chief Clerk's Office of the Minnesota House and in the spirit of seeking excellent and professional performance, this Code of Conduct is offered as a guide to employees of the Chief Clerk's Office in fulfilling its mission. Pride in public service. Conduct yourself in a manner which reflects positively on the House. Be attentive to actions that build confidence in the legislature and the legislative process. Provide courteous service to the public in order to enhance the quality and promote the images of the House. Make an ongoing commitment to understand the role of the Chief Clerk's Office in the legislative process to improve your professional knowledge about legislative process. Appreciate the importance of providing accurate information to legislator staff and the public in an unbiased manner. Dignity and respect. serve every member of the legislature, staff members, the public with dignity, respect. Understand and conform to all policies that govern the conduct of legislative employees. Teamwork. Value the interdependence of all the departments in the chief clerk's office. Each department serves an important function that contributes to the success of all. Strive toward nourishing attitudes that support a healthy work environment, teamwork, and the provisions of excellent service. Work with a positive attitude and be supportive of colleagues. Integrity. Practice a high standard of honesty and personal integrity. Demonstrate conduct that promotes confidence, responsibility, and trust. Closing, I also want to say that one of the things that we talk about to our staff, particularly at the House desk, because that's the most visible part, we talk about temperament. Temperament to me is how we conduct ourselves, how we need to be calm, positive, and professional no matter what is happening on the House floor, most of which is beyond our control. I know that members in the public are watching us, so I want our staff to always convey an image of professional calmness in our demeanor and our temperament. And I'm proud that we're able to remain so calm and professional under some very demanding and stressful situations. So I'm very proud of the professionalism our staff exhibits on a daily basis. And finally, I want to thank all of the hardworking professional staff in the chief clerk's office. Thanks to all of you for making me look good, and most importantly, for your dedication to the Minnesota House. I'm proud of everyone there. Changes in my 40 years, yes, I've seen many changes that have impacted how the legislature functions. I feel I've been honored and blessed to work here at this institution for that long. Consider myself lucky, and I'm very grateful for that opportunity. Thank you, Chair Pawlowski. Thank you, members of the Subcommittee on Legislative Process Reform, for your time today.
Chief Cook Murphy, thank you. We appreciate the detail, and we also appreciate your work. Members, are there any questions? Representative Pinter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Murphy, I just want to see if you could comment a little bit on enforcement of the rules that we have, because it seems to me that one of the arguments against adding new rules in addition to the ones that you mentioned, is that we end up enforcing our own rules to the extent they get enforced at all. I feel like I've seen in my few years here that just because it says that in the rules, it doesn't necessarily mean that in all cases we're gonna go with that. If you could just comment on that general topic of how the rules that we do have various topics, I guess, end up being enforced.
Chief Clerk Murphy.
Chair Pawlowski. Members of the subcommittee, Representative Pinto. That's a little beyond my charge here today. I do not enforce the rules. I provide guidance and support to presiding officers and others, but that's really a question for a presiding officer and how they maintain order and things like that. But there are rules that perhaps are not enforced. One rule we have is Rule 2.20. Members must keep their seats until the speaker announces adjournment. I rarely, if ever, see that enforced. Rule 2.10 states a member must not vote on a question except at the member's own seat in the chamber. I'll just leave that at that. And I know Representative Pawlowski and I have talked about this rule for a long time. Rule 2.32, order and debate. A member must not speak more than twice on the subject without leave or permission of the House. Now, that's not necessarily enforced, except under some dire circumstances on occasion. Representative Pawlowski is smiling at me. We've had those conversations, but certainly not my purview to enforce that. But I certainly know where those rules are.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe just following up that I guess I didn't realize that there may have been some violations. I guess I'll just leave it at that as well. But I guess I'm thinking especially about rules changes intended to have a more orderly conclusion to the session, and the thought that in the end, I feel like there's this imperative. This is perhaps just more of a comment, Mr. Chair, but it feels like the right time to say this, that in the end, when you've got the pressure of finishing the session on time in a certain way, then it seems like there's a lot of pressure that comes to to drive through in whatever means are necessary. And so what I wonder is sort of, as we're considering rules changes, about how we could then enforce those changes that that are put in place to be sure that they end up constraining constraining the actions of the body. And that seems like quite a balance to strike, Mr. Chair, and thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Murphy, I was interested in how you handle, when you were talking about the staff and so on, professional growth opportunities. Mm-hmm. I know, for example, as a department, you've been active historically in NCSL. Mm-hmm. In fact, Minnesota, I think, has probably been one of the more active states in that regard. But if you could comment a bit about that, because you are a relatively small department, so how you handle professional growth and other outside activities that would help your staff in that regard.
Chief Clerk Murphy.
Chair Pawlowski, members of the committee, Representative Carlson. Yes, I haven't attended these national conferences so much in the last 7-8 years, but I did for a long part of my career attend these meetings, and we have our own part of NCSL called the Society for Clerks and Secretaries, and myself and my predecessor, Al Mathewitz and Ed Burdick, we were on many panels. I would proudly say that most states look to Minnesota as a modicum of perfection, frankly, on how we operate our floor sessions. One thing that comes to my mind very quickly that we share with other states, and this is a credit to the revisor's office and our office, et cetera, you would be shocked, members, how most states don't engross bills as they move through the process. We incorporate those changes. Just look at Congress. You have seen photos there where there's chicken scratch and writing on it, but we're one of the few states that every time a bill moves through, we incorporate those changes and publish a new engrossment. But am I answering your question? Or
I guess, Mr. Chairman, I'm a bit surprised that we haven't been as active in the past few years. I haven't either, quite frankly, for other reasons. But I've always felt providing an opportunity for professional growth is important, whether it's our staff or legislators. Mm-hmm. And I do know that historically, at least, for example, our fiscal analysts have been active. Yep. With some of the other organizations as well. Particularly, my involvement historically was NCSL. Mm-hmm. But that answered part of the question. And, Mr. Chairman, if internally, when I referenced your relatively small department, and yet we don't appear to have a lot of turnover, at least as I observe, but I don't know as much about what goes on the third floor relative to staffing, but how you provide internally an opportunity for advancement and professional growth, if that's something that you watch closely or not.
Chief Clerk Murphy.
Chair Pawlowski and members of the committee, that's a good question, interesting question. Sometimes we have to go through leadership teams and request to travel and things like that. It's during certain times, depending on the economy, that's not always smiled upon, etc. But I've recently been talking with the powers that be to get our folks out to travel more. What we do in our office is we have staff meetings, and anytime a situation comes up on the floor or in the office, we use it as a moment, a teaching moment. We spend a lot of time talking about various scenarios on the floor, what came up, what the potentials are, and things like that.
And
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chair, just a couple of short comments. Years ago, I used to preside from time to time, and I remember Ed Burdick was a little bit slow when we had a point of order that came up in terms of offering his advice. He was on the phone, and he turned and he apologized, and he said, "I was on the phone with a parliamentary question. I think it was North Carolina. The chief clerk of one of their bodies had called soliciting information on a parliamentary question, and
Oh, yeah.
That was, I found, rather interesting. I was also in another state when their chief clerk indicated that when they had a question, they often turned to Minnesota. And I remembered when I heard that conversation, mm-hmm. when I was presiding and Ed Burdick was answering a question for somebody from another state. I just point that out to compliment mm-hmm. the history of our office and the respect that it has around the country.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Chair Pawlowski. Chief Clerk Murphy, just a comment before my softball question following. Yes, in the 10 years that I've been here, I've always been impressed and appreciated the calm, cool, and collected demeanor of yourself and the whole staff during our debates of 18 hours of debates, and we get kind of emotional on the floor, as you know. And to look to you guys and or come up and speak to the rest of you in a little break, just the professionalism that you have and the demeanor and the calmness that helps us, even though sometimes it appears not, is, I'm sure, appreciated that I can speak for many of my colleagues. It's always have been impressive, so thank you for that, and thank you for keeping us and myself calm at times as well.
Thank you.
For an Irishman, it's not easy, right?
Oh, I hear you.
So the question, softball question is this. At some times, the mics will be off. They'll be for whatever bug on the floor, so we cannot speak through the mics. So has there ever been a case that a member will go down to the well and use what is there to speak to the chambers?
Chief Clerk Murphy.
Chair Pawlowski and members of the subcommittee, almost. We've come close with some power shortages and things like that to coming down to the well. I can't recall anything in my 40-some years or talking to others that have longer than I do. We have backup power supplies and things like that, and we have a backup recording system that is run by battery in case we do have a power outage, et cetera. And, but no, we haven't really used the well for the microphones not working.
Chief Clerk Murphy, can you explain the difficulty in handling amendments on the House floor that are not pre-filed or amendments to amendments that are not pre-filed, the process you have to go through in making sure the amendment works?
Chair Pawlowski and members of the subcommittee, yes, prior to 2013, we did take amendments on the fly, so to speak, and not that our current system is perfect, but prior to that, you never really knew. A member would come up with an amendment, generally not in order, not perfect. They would draft these things on the fly, and we at the desk had to make sure, first of all, that the page and line fit, that they made sense, and that is a very difficult challenge during session to be able to ascertain that. I would also say, because they were half-baked, virtually, I would say, easily 70% of the amendments that were offered were then orally modified on the floor. I think some of you senior members know what I'm talking about. So, okay, we're up there taking the oral changes on the fly, incorporating that into a loosely written amendment, and we repeat it back to the body. And I think, I'm not sure, the body probably had a real good idea of how it read. So it was very problematic. It was very difficult for us when a member would come up and slap down an amendment of 15, 20 pages to either post it online in a timely fashion, much less make copies for the members. it was problematic, never knowing how many amendments were there, getting on the verge of third reading, and then a whole new stack would be slapped up there. And yes, those were some very trying, challenging times taking amendments on the fly.
Yeah, Chief Clerk Murphy, I bring it up because our journal is posted, as you said, 1 hour after session, mm-hmm. or approximately that much time. Once it's posted, mm-hmm. the public seems to think that is actually what we've done. And in effect, if the amendment isn't clear, then we have another issue. We have posted something that probably nobody understands, and yet it's part of the journal, and we're moving forward. Just as a reminder to individuals, perhaps, to take a little time and thought, mm-hmm. Maybe 24 hours before they want to do an amendment. It's just a suggestion.
Chair Pawlowski, members of the committee, you're absolutely right, because the amendments that we would post online, so you'd access on the web during session, because of the modifications and changes, they didn't accurately reflect what you voted on or what was adopted. The journal did, but not those amendments that were posted. And you are correct. There was a lot of confusion as to what was posted during session without the modifications.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, as a follow-up, if you'd care to comment, in our early days,
yes,
predated you by a little bit, but we used to have the Committee of the Whole.
Mm-hmm.
And if you'd comment on how that approach would interact on the questions that we've talked about with amendments. And so members are aware we would go into a Committee of the Whole, debate the bills, take up amendments and so on, and then typically the following day we would adopt the report from the Committee of the Whole. And that was a bit of a check in terms of some of the issues that you're talking about in terms of clarification and so on. It slowed the process down because you debated an issue potentially twice, although when we adopted the Committee of the Whole and went through the bills, there wasn't anywhere near the debate that there would have been during the Committee of the Whole. But if you could comment on that approach, mm-hmm, relative to some of the issues we're dealing now with the 24-hour rule and vague amendments and what have you.
Chief Clerk, before you answer, you may want to explain to some of the newer members what the Committee of the Whole was.
Chair Pawlowski and members of the subcommittee and Representative Carlson. The Committee of the Whole, it's a little bit of a multifaceted question, but it was a system whereby bills were heard on the House floor in the order in which they were placed on the general orders calendar in a little more loose environment than formal floor session. We would resolve ourselves into the Committee of the Whole. The speaker would be referred to as the chair of the Committee of the Whole. We would debate, discuss, and amend bills. Then we would adopt the report of the Committee of the Whole, and then we would print those bills with the amendments adopted in the Committee of the Whole, and then take them up the next legislative day, which might be the next day or two or three days later. It was kind of this laying over period so people could sit back and reflect on it, and it had its positives. But Representative Carlson, Representative Pawlowski, and others, in reality, as you recall, the Committee of the Whole was in place in January and February. But by mid-March, what were we doing? We were special ordering bills, which frankly bypassed the Committee of the Whole, and which is currently kind of the process we have now where we calendar bills, et cetera. So I would say back in the days when we had the Committee of the Whole, we probably might have done 15, 20 bills like that. But when March came and the crunch came, they kind of expedited that by declaring bills special orders, if you will, back in that day.
And Mr. Chairman, you helped me recall some of that process because it's been obviously a long time.
Been a while,
but what I was interested in was whether that approach would help with some of what we're struggling with today, you know, the 24-hour rule and the ability of members to amend a bill with the timeline that's in place. You know, there's mixed feelings within, mm-hmm, the legislative body about the 24-hour rule, whether we're talking about, mm-hmm, committees or whether we're talking about the House floor. And so really my question was, would the Committee of the Whole process, as limited as it was then, but if that kind of approach were used, would it resolve some of the issues that we're struggling with today?
Chief Clerk Murphy.
Representative Pawlowski, members of the committee, Representative Carlson, I'm not sure if it would. Like I said before, I'm not necessarily here to advocate for or against that, but if it is the wish and in your wisdom you want to go back to the Committee of the Whole, we can certainly facilitate that and make that work.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not advocating that necessarily. Just was, uh-huh, soliciting information in terms of whether it would be a potential approach to resolve some of the issues that we're currently debating, and I'd have to think that through. I remember it quite well at the time. I had forgotten that it was limited to basically the first 2 months, but I do remember the special ordering of the bills. I think it was Rule 110 yet.
That one, too.
Thank you.
Representative Sandell.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Murphy, as I remember, there were about 3,500 bills introduced in this session, maybe a few more. Do you have any idea what number or what percentage of those were actually heard in committee?
Clerk Murphy.
Chair Pawlowski and members of the subcommittee, no, I don't have that available to me now. I'm sure we can figure that out, but I don't have that with me right now.
Representative Sandell.
Thank you. That's all. I know.
Thank you.
No. Representative Cassidy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
In regards with the discussion of pre-filing amendments, Rule 3.33, it's my understanding that we're going to be deviating from that a little bit going into the upcoming session. Can you discuss or maybe clarify for us if you know how we're changing that a little bit? If we're, I don't think we're getting rid of it completely, but we're kind of altering it, I think. And then what, how that impacts your office and then also the flow of the legislative body.
Chief Clerk Murphy.
Chair Pawlowski, members of the subcommittee, Representative Koznick. Honestly, I don't know what's people are talking about. I've heard rumors like everyone else. I've had questions, but I've not really seen any hard and fast proposal on altering that rule or changing that rule. So okay. I don't know.
Representative Koznick, anything else?
Well, thank you. That's fair answer, and I guess we're in the same boat. Yeah. We'll have to look for some more clarification here on where leadership is going to be on this. But I think there's certainly positives, you know, in terms of the flow of ideas and and the will of the body more broadly instead of more concentrated decision making and where we go on legislation. I would presume from your previous comments and just common sense that it would create more work and kind of disorder or chaos from your office perspective, but I think it's an opportunity to have a little more input from members on the bills as we're being debated. So we'll have to look for leadership to give us a little bit more direction on whether or not we will be deviating from 3.33.
Representative Koznick, I believe there was a discussion during the special session and the conclusion of the special session relating to that rule. It does remind me of a statement I've used before that there's nothing special about a special session, and perhaps we'll find out how special it was. So, members, any other questions for the chief clerk or his staff? Representative Pop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Murphy, for being here and providing an exhaustive list of what you do, and it's so impressive because everything that you and your staff do is just done at such a high mark. It's wonderful to see and to hear about. So thank you. I do have a question. It's kind of a little bit along the lines of Representative Carlson, but it's about succession planning. So in the 15 years that I've served, had three chief clerks. And I think that that's kind of unusual because I know Mr. Burdick was here and he was at the tail end when I started, but then to have two additional. But I know that your staff, for the most part, there's a longevity to the people that serve. And I'm just wondering about what kind of succession planning you've been doing, and it, you know, the professional development to learn what to do and how to do it, how that's going on, and you know, just knowing that people when they're in the fray. I mean, that's really when you learn. Personally speaking, yes. I know that when you actually are doing something that you're not used to doing, you it is coming at you fast and furious, and you're trying to figure out, okay, what do you do next? So just wondering about how you adapt your staff to new staff coming in and learning how to do the job under such extreme pressure.
Chief Clerk Murphy.
Chair Pawlowski, members of the committee, Representative Poppy. That's a great question. We have quite an onboarding process when we hire new staff, from reading them the code of conduct to teaching classes. I personally teach a couple of them, and so do other members of our staff, about the process. We also kind of have them shadow different people in the office. And I think you've probably noticed out on the House floor, different members of our staff being out there at the west end of the desk and really shadowing and helping out and gaining insight. And then before, as I mentioned, we use a lot of these things as teachable moments. There are more conversations that happen in our office about something that perhaps happened on the floor, perhaps what we could have done better and learn from that as well as as well as we can. We do have backup plans for everybody in our office in case someone is absent for a health reason or something like that. And yes, we do have a succession plan, orderly plan. There is a chief clerk, a first assistant chief clerk, et cetera. There is a process in place there for that. So thank you for that question. And
Chief Clerk Murphy, we have seen repeatedly on the House floor entire rows voting without the members being in their seats. And we know there is a rule that says they must vote from their seat. And I know I've, at least on one occasion, called a point of order on it. So if a point of order is called on that rule, then what is the procedure with the speaker or speaker pro tem if a point of order is called when obviously members are voting and they are not in their seats?
Chair Pawlowski, members of the subcommittee, if a point of order is raised on that, I'm not sure that they would rule on that, but they would certainly remind members of Rule 2.10 that states that a member has to be at his or her desk in order to vote.
I bring that up, too, because it is painfully obvious on occasion that we have whole sections that are not on the floor voting, and one member is going up and down the aisle. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I did want to ask, though, I think custom and usage supersedes the House rules. Is that correct, Mr. Chief Clerk?
Chief Clerk Murphy.
Chair Pawlowski, members of the subcommittee, Representative Pinto, no. That does not supersede the rules.
Okay.
Custom and usage comes into play when there isn't a rule that covers that particular action or something like that, and it becomes a matter of, well, how have we handled that in the past?
Mr. Chair, I may be thinking of Masons, that it supersedes Masons, but not our rules. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative Pinto, there have been occasions when this has occurred, and we have had members take, unfortunately, votes that they did not want to take because one member was voting for them. So I bring it up again that you should be in your seat, you should be voting, and you should be aware of what's going on.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Carlson.
You know, something that, Mr. Chairman, could be talked about on that question, one of the problems sometimes is conference committee and how conference committee times are set when we're in session, because I think that aggravates the very issue that you're bringing up. And I used to advocate, going back to when Fred Norton was speaker, what I called the a conference committee week, where you would reduce the number of floor sessions to allow the conference committees to do their work, so you'd have less disruption of the conference committee when you had a call of the House and that kind of thing. Or the Senate strongly enforces that you have to be at your desk when voting, and that disrupts the conference committees. So I think there's something that needs to be worked out relative to how that issue is handled. We've had, and you probably maybe recall, we've had the flip side where members have not wanted someone to vote for them, and they've been in a conference committee, and then at campaign time, it's been raised about the number of missed votes they've had.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I was interested in some sort of a structure that would provide that when the House is in session, either conference committees don't meet, but that you'd have a window where you could work around that, because we do have to convene, if you did have a conference committee week, time for the paperwork at the front desk, if nothing else, or other issues that have to be dealt with. So it would be kind of a calendar approach to how you would handle conference committee time when you're, and I'm talking about mainly when we're dealing with the omnibus bills, mm-hmm. and you have people that are downstairs. If there's a call, obviously you come up. But I think that's what drives a lot of what we're talking about, especially near the end of the session, something that maybe this group could think about how we handle that calendar period of time.
But Representative Carlson, I agree to a point, but only to a point. When I'm off the House floor, I ask that my vote be locked and that no one push my button. I would rather explain that I was somewhere else and I couldn't vote than explain a bad vote that someone else made for me. So I agree that there could be a balancing of the calendar. But when we're seeing the type of lack of attendance on voting that we've seen, those people were not on a conference committee, those members. They were somewhere, but I don't know where. So, again, it's just a reminder to be in your seat and vote. But I agree with you. There are some conflicts. But I would rather have my button locked and then explain that I was on a conference committee or I was doing something that was part of the job of a legislator, but I just wasn't on the floor, rather than having somebody else push that button. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I was saying that I think that's a particularly difficult period of time when we're dealing with the omnibus bills and that there may be some way we could provide a solution. I think what you're talking about is a general period of time. I do remember we had a little problem, and that will be probably eliminated for the next 100 years, but when members had to go downstairs and outside to the bathroom and make it back up to vote, sometimes they had to move pretty fast. But we probably won't remodel for quite a time. But, you know, my point is that sometimes there are circumstances, but the biggest problem that I was trying to point to was during the omnibus period. And I remember, you know, I'm full of stories after 48 years, but Arnie Carlson, member of the House, gets up and he says, I see that the speaker, who was Martin Sable, is being voted and he's nowhere in the chamber. And a couple minutes later, Martin came up and we were in recess to a call of the chair. This was probably, you could research it, maybe 9, 10 o'clock at night. He reconvened us at 5 a.m. in the morning. The speaker was on the tax conference committee. Sable just was very into taxes and wasn't long after the Minnesota miracle had passed and there were a lot of issues. And so there are those kinds of things. And the problems have sometimes been during that conference committee period, whether you're talking about the Speaker of the House or individual members who are on a conference committee, and the tug of war between being in a conference committee and being on the House floor is sometimes problematic. And I won't do it here, but I could point to one member who was on a conference committee, had his board locked, and lost his seat over the number of missed votes. So that's why I, at that point in time, became an advocate. Well, we got to do something a little bit different during that crunch time so that there's less conflict between members who are on a conference committee and also having duties on the House floor. If we did something during that period of time, would that solve all the problems? I think that's what you and I are talking about. I would have to say, no, it doesn't solve all the problems, but it would solve a major one, in my humble opinion. But I'll just stop there. I don't want to delay the committee on
No, Representative Carlson, you raise an excellent point, and I would hope, given recent legislative sessions, that we would restore the conference committees to that particular level of activity. So then we could discuss that issue. As we know, conference committees of late have not been functioning.
Mr. Chairman, there's a lot of directions we could go.
There are, and that's why we're here. Any other questions, members? All right. Thank you again, and thank you to your staff, too, for all the excellent work that they did.
Thank you, Chair Pawlowski, and thank you, members of the committee.
Members, the next item on the agenda, and I'm going to go back up to the approval of the minutes. I'm going to go to Representative Poppy. She was vice chair when I chaired the Government Operations Committee, so I think she knows the procedure. Representative Poppy, do you have a motion for us?
I'd like to move approval of the minutes.
Representative Poppy moves approval of the minutes. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Minutes approved. Thank you, Representative Poppy. You fulfilled that quite well. Next item on the agenda is the presentation by MMB staff, Budget Economic Forecast. Members, this goes back to where we had the previous meeting and the discussion of the budget. and the fact that the budget is one of our constitutional responsibilities to pass by the end of session, a balanced budget, hopefully. So we're going back to having MMB present budget and economic forecasts, and welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Britta Rayton. I'm the Assistant Commissioner at MMB for Budget Services, also the State Budget Director. Today I'm here to talk about the budget and forecast process at MMB. The information I've provided gives an overview of the timeline of the base budget development and the forecast process, as well as the submission of the governor's budget recommendations to the legislature. The presentation shows the process in chronological order, but I'm going to walk through each component of the process separately. The biennial budget development process begins months before the budget is actually submitted to the legislature. The first step typically occurs in April or May, and it's consultation with the legislature about the form and format of the biennial budget documents. The consultation is required under law and usually takes the form of structured meetings with fiscal staff for the legislature, as well as memos communicating the proposed structure of the documents and sample documents to legislative leadership. Once the form and format of the budget documents is finalized, MMB issues instructions to all agencies, boards, and commissions in three steps. The first is instructions about budget narratives. The second is instructions for establishing base budgets. And the third is instructions about submitting requests for change items to the governor's budget process. The first set of instructions about agency program and activity narratives also includes instructions about budget structure. Some agencies do propose changes to the structure of their budget at this point in time, and those changes are vetted through the executive budget officer at MMB, as well as the relevant fiscal staff in the legislature. Agencies begin updating their narratives for existing programs and activities and adding narratives for new programs and activities that have been passed since the last document was published. And part of this work includes updating performance information. Those performance metrics are included on the narratives in accordance with law, and those are updated by the agencies, often in consultation with our executive budget officers at MMB and with our results management team at MMB. Then the executive budget officers, once the agencies submit their narrative documents, review the documents for clarity and for completeness of the information, and they work with agencies on edits. So those usually come back to the executive budget officers at MMB in August. And then the complete narrative documents are typically posted to our website at the end of September or early October. We typically shoot for October 1st to have those narrative documents on our website. So the narratives are really a comprehensive inventory of state services, programs, and activities, and those again are on our website typically by October 1st before a biennial budget session. The second set of instructions is for preparing fiscal base budget information in the budget system. These instructions are sent to agencies in late June or early August, and agencies begin their work on the base budget following the load of fiscal close data from our accounting system, our SWIFT system, to the budget system. And this has to wait until after we actually go through what we call hard close, which happens in mid-August. So the budget system is called BPAS, the Budget Planning and Analysis System, and users across the state have access to this system to prepare their budget information. And the process of reconciling the base budget in the system involves agencies ensuring that the base budget conforms with current law. We do a current law base budget, so it is based on the laws passed in the current biennium and pushing that information forward. And the base budget is defined under law. So for the majority of non-forecast programs, the base is simply the appropriation amount in the second year of the current biennium pushed forward. The system automatically copies the appropriation amount in the second year of the current biennium forward, and then agency staff make adjustments as required by law. And these are called base adjustments. So some examples of base adjustments would include eliminating funding if the funding was passed on a one-time basis. So it would push that funding forward, and then they would do a base adjustment to eliminate that funding if it was only one time in nature. adjusting funding if the legislature had passed language that set the tails at a higher amount or a lower amount. So if there was some deviation from the assumption that the second year of the biennium just pushed us forward, as well as adjusting for forecast changes and forecast spending programs. Agencies also update at this point in time their revenue estimates, including estimates for federal funds, fees, and other special revenues. And then agencies also reflect transfers that are required or allowed by law. As part of the base budget, agencies make assumptions about how their operating dollars will be spent, showing estimates of compensation costs and technology costs as part of their base budget expenditure projections going forward. Once agencies complete their work, the base information is reviewed in detail by executive budget officers at MMB to make sure it is conforming with current law and that the estimates are reasonable on their revenue items. Detailed base budget books are then published online on November 30th, as required by law. And these books combine the narrative information that was published on October 1 with fiscal information for each program and activity showing the base budget information for each. And so those two pieces of information are blended together, and then the books are available on our website. So that base budget information that is completed by November 30th is also providing the basis of our November forecast. The November forecast is typically released in the first week of December. It's still called the November forecast because it's based on November economic data. The economic analysis unit at MMB, which is led by Dr. Columbakidis, completes the forecast of the primary general fund revenues for the state, so income tax, sales tax, and corporate tax. These projections are built on national economic data provided by Minnesota's macroeconomic consultant, IHS Markit. That national economic data is then applied to our Minnesota-specific models to provide projections for those major revenue sources into the general fund. On the expenditure side of our forecast, executive budget officers at MMB work with the relevant agencies to review their assumptions and projections for forecast expenditure programs. And this primarily occurs in the areas of human services, education, and property tax aids and credits, as well as projecting spending in some open appropriations we have in law. These projections are typically based on caseloads, actual experience, demographic, economic data, as well as income data, as well as changes in federal law. And we see that often has an impact in the HHS space. So budget officers work with agencies to make sure there is agreement about these projections, and then we share this data with legislative fiscal staff 3 weeks in advance of the forecast release in accordance with law. And fiscal staff in many cases also have access to the models that are being used to review and flag any issues or concerns that they have in advance of the forecast as well. With the forecast release, we publish a fund balance as well as a forecast book that describes in detail the assumptions and projections in the forecast and also explains any drivers of change in the forecast from our end of session projections. So the third set of instructions we provide to agencies is for building the budget and requests for change items in the governor's budget process. These instructions are typically sent to agencies in August, and the budget requests are due back to MMB by October 15th. And the change page template that we provide to agencies is also shared with the legislature early in the process when we're getting buy-in to the form and format of the information. And that template collects information about how much the request will cost or save on an annual basis, what those dollars will be used for, including how they will be spent on compensation, grants, or IT, as well as information about anticipated results and performance metrics. So EBOs work with agencies to understand these requests and to analyze these requests in advance of the November forecast. In addition to the change item form that we provide agencies, agencies can also, starting last year, complete an evidence-based proposal form. And this form is intended to highlight those budget proposals where they have an investment that's supported by research and evidence of effectiveness. Our results management team at MMB then reviews those forms and reviews the research that is actually supporting the proposal to make sure it is a level of research with a level of rigor that we would support classifying that proposal as an evidence-based proposal. So decision-making with the governor begins immediately following the November forecast when the size of any surplus or deficit in the upcoming biennium is known. In some years, we also need to issue additional instructions to agencies at that point based on the magnitude of the change in the forecast. Additionally, some of the initial requests from agencies when they're based on underlying forecast information need to be repriced to reflect the new forecast that's released in December. So the governor's budget is then submitted to the legislature by the fourth Tuesday in January, unless there is a new governor, in which case that is due the third Tuesday in February. And the governor's budget submission includes a change page for every change recommended by the governor, as well as updated fiscal pages. So taking those same fiscal pages from the base budget submission and updating them to reflect the governor's recommended change and showing that change relative to base. And then following the governor's submission of the budget to the legislature, we do a second budget and economic forecast, and this is completed in February and provided by the end of February to the legislature. And with the release in the last week of February, following that, we reprice the original governor's budget submission and provide a revised budget, typically by the third week in March. So the presentation that you have up here just goes through this all in chronological order. And then the last page just talks a bit about what's provided with the governor's budget submission. There are over 4,000 pages provided that give details on the existing services and programs across state government, as well as a detailed change page for every item of change within the governor's budget and detailed fiscal pages for all programs, activities, and agencies. So I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you. Ms. Wright, the discussion that we've had in this committee and the discussions we've had in session deal with the fact that we have failed to come to grips with the budget by the end of session and then have had to do the entire budget, well, this past session in 24 hours, which is a bit of a daunting task and leaves many people unsatisfied. So the discussion we had in the last committee hearing was the difference between a base budget and then any other type of revenue. And since we've had a large turnover in the legislature, particularly in the House, I think some members are still coming to understand the difference between a base budget, and the example we used at the last committee hearing was K-12 education. Mm-hmm. If we had moved to a base budget approach for budgeting, how would that change what you just presented to us? The legislature was going to say at a fixed date we were going to pass a base budget and then work after we had passed the base budget on whatever the problem or surplus would be.
Mr. Chair, the base budget is essentially what we provide on November 30th, and in most cases there's no growth within that budget. As I mentioned, the base is defined in law, and it's the second year appropriation in the current biennium pushed forward. We do have some cases where there is growth built into forecast programs, but that's only on about 25% of the total state budget, and it doesn't always fully fund growth in those programs. In some cases, there's a growth factor built into a formula, such as the special education formula. In some cases, there is some cost recognition in a formula, so that builds in some inflation. But generally, there is no inflationary growth built into the expenditure side of the base budget.
Members, I'm going to let you in. Representative McDowell.
Thank you, Chair Plosky. In your question, would that be similar to then zero-based budgeting? And if not, what are your thoughts?
I'm going to deflect that to Ms. Reichton, and she can respond.
Mr. Chair, zero-based budgeting is something somewhat different. So a zero base means that either for the entirety of the budget or for a portion of the budget, you start the discussion at zero instead of assuming the most recent year pushed forward. Some states have tried this. It's a pretty cumbersome process to take the budget down to zero, and it can be confusing, particularly in areas a forecast program such as K-12 education. So beginning a session suggesting we are going to spend zero on K-12 education and issuing a surplus or deficit number based on that is there's some transparency questions about the understanding of the public about what that means. And so a zero-based budget would be different than the base budget we talk about in our process.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many states have automatic inflation adjustments in their budgets?
That's right.
Mr. Chair, offhand, I don't know the answer to that. We work closely with the National Association of State Budget Officers, though, and we could ask for that information and get that answer for you.
Ms. Wright, in your statement, you mentioned the February forecast, and that's sort of the trigger by which then the legislature takes a little bit more seriously, or sometimes very seriously, the budget. But that's February. We're done in May. So the February forecast comes out. We have part of February. We have April, May, and March, April, May, and that's it to do a budget that is now approaching $50 billion. So one of the discussions that we're trying to grapple with here is how to facilitate a better understanding of that budget earlier so that we would be able to finish by our constitutional deadline. Mm-hmm. Would you have a suggestion as to how to do that?
Mr. Chair, in terms of if the question is about moving up that forecast, I think it's just simply a trade-off between the accuracy of the forecast numbers and the timeline allowed to make those budget decisions. I did have a conversation about that with Dr. Kolumbakidis before today to understand what we would lose in terms of forecast accuracy if we moved the February forecast up. The February forecast, typically holiday sales information is known by the end of January. So the February forecast incorporates information about holiday sales. Also, our forecasts fall when they do because there is quarterly information that is released, again, on a quarterly basis, and that quarterly information is not available until February. So if we did a forecast, say, in January, it would be based on a full quarter previous to that. But again, it's just a trade-off between accuracy and the amount of time that's available for decision-making. In terms of just having an understanding of the budget and the decisions that need to be made, we do publish the narratives and the base information by the end of November with the intention of making that information publicly available to the public and to the legislature. So we would be happy to engage in conversations after that release of the base information to help cultivate an understanding of the existing base budget in advance of the forecasts.
Members, questions? Representative McDowell.
Yeah, just a comment, thank you, Chair Pelosi. In regards to the projected budget forecast, the revenue, again, it's only projected. It's still in the taxpayers' wallets, and it's projected. Yet we at the legislature spend their money before it's even earned. And it always is surprising and kind of a failure, I think, on my part and the legislature's part that we're spending people's money before it's even collected. It's only a projection. Many, many things can happen that will dictate what is brought in. Henceforth, we have surpluses and deficits. So I think that as a legislature, we really need to, and if there's a mechanism to do that, to allow for that projected deficit, if you will, without already dispersing and voting on and passing into law, spending that close to $50 billion. And we always get ahead of ourselves. Now, I understand that every department, the HHS and transportation, education, everybody wants that money and important programs and funding, but we as a legislature really need to get a better handle on it, in my opinion, and quit playing with that, you know, the projected income that sometimes doesn't always come to fruition. Is there anything that could be done in your opinion, Ms. Wrighton?
Ms. Wright.
Mr. Chair, I think the structure we have in place of having two forecasts each year is intended to be responsive to that concern so that we are continually updating those forecasts and making sure we're capturing information about changes in economic and income conditions that would affect the amount of revenue available within the budget.
Ms. Wright, we've had a question that was submitted for Representative Barr, and he is not here. I'm going to read it and see if you can give an answer to it.
Sure.
He asked, why do we allow one legislature to influence the next budget through manipulation of the tails? Would not a current service budget process be not only more transparent, but also more reflective of the views of the current legislature and, by extension, the voters of Minnesota? I'm not exactly sure what he means by a current services budget, but you might. So, Ms. Wright.
Mr. Chair, typically a current services budget would be referring to a budget that the base that's assumed assumes enough funding to provide the same level of service in the next biennium. So typically that would mean it includes some measure of inflation on the cost side in order to maintain the current level of services, maintain the current level of staffing. So I'm assuming that's what the representative is meaning in that situation. The first part of the question, it sounds like, is a concern about when we set tails numbers in the legislative process that are different than the spending in the current year. And that can be manipulated in two different ways. It could be that we increase spending in the tails, or it could be that we fund a program on a one-time basis that really isn't one-time in nature. So if we're not projecting enough revenue in the tails, but there is still a desire to fund a program that's ongoing, sometimes it is funded only on a one-time basis. We, fiscal analysts, M&B staff, certainly discourage that. If it's an ongoing program, we encourage decision makers to reflect an ongoing cost of that program and not just fund it on a one-time basis, because it leaves a cliff. We also note on any fiscal tracking sheets, and this is part of our budget rules that are agreed to between M&B and fiscal staff, we note any places where the tails increase beyond the current projection, the projections in the current biennium that we're budgeting for, particularly if there's increases even beyond that tails tracking. So if it's beyond the biennium that we're tracking through, we note on the fiscal tracking sheets what that growth looks like into the future so that decision makers have that information.
Ms. Wright, could the legislature do a better job, particularly in January and February, of getting its members to understand the base budget before we even move to what might be a surplus or new spending? And I raise the point not just in K-12, but across all the accounts, that it, perhaps if we actually understood that we had made this commitment, and that commitment, if you make a change, it's going to be, shall we say, interesting in a K-12 system or in a higher ed system or in health and human services. So could we do a better job in January and February of understanding these base budgets?
Mr. Chair, I don't want to comment on whether the legislature could do a better job, but M&B is certainly willing and able to work with members to walk through the base budget information and help build that understanding of the base and what is and is not included in the base. And I'm sure I see Bill Marks here as well. I'm sure fiscal staff is also willing to offer that sort of information because they understand it in the same depth.
That's right, and I raise the point because as members begin to introduce bills, and in this case 2,922, if anyone's counting in the House for this session, they raise bills that have funds in them that are in excess of sometimes what's actually in the base of a certain account. And yet with no understanding that if you want to pass that bill, you've exceeded the base of what's already committed, and there's no possibility of passing that bill with that amount in it. It's not possible. So I raise it, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but I think we could do a better job in the legislature of having members understand the responsibility of the base budget as opposed to what happens after the base budget, particularly with some of the bills that are introduced. That's not a response to you. It's a question or a statement that I'm making on understanding budgets as opposed to understanding bills. And those are two different topics. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, a couple of points. Just a comment when you were talking about the February forecast and timeline, just to remind members, Rule 4.03, the Ways and Means Committee has 25 days after the forecast to pass the budget resolution. And a lot goes into preparing that during that 25-day period. I think it's fair to say that both caucuses typically use the maximum number of days in preparing for the budget resolution, but that's another factor when you talk about the timeline in terms of how we prepare the budget resolution, whether it's the Republicans in control or the Democrats. That's the window to get it done. Maybe there's some things that could be looked at there that would help the timeline, but I do want to underscore that it's not a total void. A lot is going on during that 25-day period within the various fiscal divisions and committees, and work with the committee chairs in terms of their budgetary needs, and also with the administration, whether it's a Democratic or Republican administration. So a lot happens during that 25 days, but keep in mind when you're looking at the calendar that that plays a role, at least the first year of the biennium. Other thing I was going to ask, though, if you could touch on the role of the Council of Economic Advisors and how those numbers are put together, maybe in a very general way, the type of people who serve on the council and the role of the state economist, and then ultimately the report coming out, well, soon it'll be coming out either late November or December. I think you're releasing it in December 6th or something like that is when it'll go public this time. But if you could explain that process, because that's probably under the radar screen of most members.
That's right.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, and I don't want to speak for Dr. Kalimbakidis, so it might be worth bringing Dr. Kalimbakidis in at some point to talk about the process that the state economist goes through in preparing the revenue side of the forecast. But I can talk about it at a high level. So there is a Council of Economic Advisors that reviews our national data that we receive from IHS Markit. They meet twice in advance of preparing a forecast to give advice on whether they think that the national forecast information is accurate, whether they believe it's reflecting what is actually occurring in Minnesota, and just giving advice to the state economist and her team about some considerations as they are preparing the forecast of Minnesota revenues using the Minnesota models. The Council of Economic Advisors is, as it sounds, a number of economists. They are representative of different areas of the state. Many of them have served on the Council of Economic Advisors for a number of years, and I don't know the tenure of all of them, but they've been on the council for a number of years. In the end, they draft a statement that is part of our forecast release, speaking to their concerns or how they think the national data is reflective of Minnesota's economic situation.
Representative Carlson.
And Mr. Chairman, and I, as part of that, when I asked you the question, MMB has a presence at the table.
Yep.
It's usually these days Myron Franz. There is involvement by MMB. But you do have a number of leading economists, and there is some legislative involvement, very limited. Both the majority, the chair of Ways and Means, and the minority lead sits in on those meetings, and then our Senate counterparts. What's being discussed is embargoed. We don't participate, we just listen. But both parties are present for those discussions. And you have economists that range from, some of them from the academic community, some of them from the large banking entities are sometimes present, as well as the Federal Reserve. Probably one of the reasons that that's all embargoed, if one of us went out of the room and said, well, the Federal Reserve for this region says something, you know, that would probably create headlines, but it would probably be the only time you'd be in the room after that because you just don't, you don't share. You wait for it to come out on the 7th, and that's true with it's embargoed from the administration and, as well as the legislature. But it is an important part of that, putting together the forecast, and that's referenced here on the agenda, you know, the forecasting. And it's something that the typical member probably isn't necessarily in tune with what goes on there. So that's why I was sharing a bit.
Ms. Wright.
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, thank you for mentioning that the legislative staff and legislators are part of those discussions or in those discussions, because I think that's an important feature of the work with the forecast, is that we are engaging, we're sharing the expenditure side data with legislative staff 3 weeks in advance of the forecast, and legislators and legislative staff are in the room for the discussions around the underlying data that feed into the revenue projections as well. So it is in that extent a kind of a shared process with the legislature.
We've got three members here. Representative Runbeck, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Wrighton, so I'm hearing you say that the MMB's involvement in the budget, I mean, there are some times when you see red flags and, you know, you warn, I don't know, you're warning the legislature then about that maybe these projections or these costs exceed norms. But anyway, it just seems in a way, I'm questioning, is there more than a rubber stamp sort of role that you play to the governor's budget? I mean, I'm thinking about 20 years ago and more, when we came through a tremendous technological revolution, let's just say, productivity dividends, in my view, never came through in the state government process. We didn't see, you know, as we saw in other industries, where you got more done with the less, let's just say. So I'm just curious, you know, to what extent do you have an independent voice where, you know, you are providing some input to the governor or to the legislature on really maybe what's happening elsewhere in other industries?
Ms. Wright.
Mr. Chair, MMB is an advisor in the room as the governor is making decisions, but of course, at the end of the day, we're not the elected official. And so similar to fiscal staff in the legislature, they provide advice as legislators are putting a bill together and making decisions on final budgets. But the ultimate decision-making lies with the elected official. But we certainly flag issues of long-term sustainability of decisions, of places where spending or revenue projections are concerning, and we do that historically. We've done that also through the fiscal note process and just the process of pricing out proposed changes.
Chair, I could follow up. So I presume there's a body of statute pertaining to MMB. I mean, has that changed over time in terms of what the legislature wants you to look at or you know, provide comment on?
Mr. Chair, yeah, Minnesota Statute 16A relates to MMB. It's quite extensive in terms of the expectations. We do have oversight of state agency spending in kind of a statewide CFO role for our commissioner. And then we do the projections for the forecast with kind of an arm's length distance from the political side. So that is done by nonpartisan staff and by the state economist. And so that's the body of legislation. It has changed over time. There have been things added to it in terms of reports to the legislature and responsibilities.
Thank you.
Representative Kostick, I've got you next. No, Representative Sandel.
Commissioner and Mr. Chair, this is my first time around, and I have to admit that I wasn't always confident exactly what was going on as far as legislation or budgeting is concerned. But in one of the committees I serve, our initial target was $900 million of new spending. 3 weeks later, that target went down to $740 million. And by the time the session was over, it was $540 million. Now, my concern is that had we known more accurately throughout the session what our final budget was going to be, our conversations and our discussions and our strategy and I think our priorities might have had more precise and probably more effective results. Is that a political issue, a political problem, or is it something that we can work out with more accuracy and maybe with reform with MMB?
That's right.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure I'm entirely tracking. So I'm assuming the first number cited was based on a November forecast.
Yes.
And then the subsequent February forecast.
Right.
And we did see a significant change in the forecast numbers between November and February this year. And that's just due to changes in the underlying national economic projections on the revenue side. It was primarily a change on the revenue side of the projections. From February forward, there would have been no changes to the forecast because we don't do another forecast at that point in time. So any changes in target, I think, would have been internal to legislative decision making.
Representative Sandow.
Mr. Chair, would it be more efficient or maybe provide us a little bit more direction in conversations in the committee to avoid making projections based on the November forecast and just wait and be a little bit more accurate with February?
That's right.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so the November forecast is in place in order to inform the governor's budget because the governor's mm-hmm. budget needs to be submitted in January in a typical year. And so that forecast is occurring in order for the governor to create a budget proposal. I think waiting until the February forecast for a governor's proposal would really back up the process. So my understanding, and I wasn't here when the November and February forecasts were first determined as the dates that they happened, but it's the November forecast is intended to inform the governor's process, and then the update occurs in February so that the legislature is acting with the most up-to-date information.
One more follow-up, if I may. Is the governor's forecast then based not only on information from MMB, but also what she or he may expect from proposed revenues?
Ms. Wright.
Mr. Chair and Representative, just to clarify, it's not a governor's forecast. It's still a forecast done by nonpartisan staff at MMB, but it's done at a time where it can provide the baseline projections for the governor to build on top of with his projections. So there's nothing about the governor's proposals that are built into that forecast. It's a baseline of what the base budget would be and what forecast revenues and forecast expenditures would be in forecast programs. Existing in current law.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Members, I have one more item on the agenda, and to try to get done on time, I had a request to illustrate the inflation on the budget. So if we would have Scott Kronquist come down, and thank you very much, Ms. Wright. We'll probably be revisiting your issue. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Scott Kronquist. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. AMSD represents 48 school districts that enroll collectively just over one half of the students in the state of Minnesota. And Mr. Chairman, I just quickly have to comment that I really enjoyed Chief Clerk Murphy's presentation and the amazing work that they do. And it actually made me feel a little bit old, though, as well, because I actually remember a lot of those historical events that he talked about. And then it dawned on me that it was actually 30 years ago next month that I started working for the Minnesota House of Representatives as a committee administrator. And so those years have certainly flown by, and And I can actually remember when Representative Carlson did chair the Education Committee. Before I begin, share a few comments about the budgeting process and the impact it has on schools. I want to really look back to a couple of major changes that were made in the early 2000s. To be exact, in 2001, the legislature, the K-12 bill that year included a change to repeal what was then the general education levy. You might recall that was a statewide levy that was set by the legislature. It was fully equalized, and that played a significant role in how we funded education in Minnesota. That year, we were running a significant surplus, and the legislature and governor decided to eliminate that levy and instead replace it and have the state assume a much greater role in funding education through state income and sales tax collections. So that occurred in 2001 session and actually became effective in 2003. As you all know, later in 2001, after the session had adjourned, we of course experienced the 9/11 attack, and the economy took a nosedive. And as the legislature came back in 2002, all of a sudden, instead of a surplus, we were facing a significant budget shortfall. And one of the methods that was used to address the shortfall in the 2002 session was to remove inflation from the expenditure side of the budget forecast. And that has been the case ever since. So prior to 2002, when you got your November forecast, it was assuming that state expenditures were going to increase by inflation. That was the picture that you got heading into the governor's budget and into your legislative session. You should have a handout in your packet that looks like this. It's a graph. And this shows you what the impact has been on the education funding formula since those changes happened. Now, I'm not going to say that it's strictly due to those two changes. I mean, a lot of things have happened over the years. We've had further recessions, and, you know, including the Great Recession. And so a lot of other things have occurred. But I think it would be a fair assumption to say that those two significant changes in 2001 and 2002 probably had some impact and is offers some explanation of why our general education funding formula has fallen behind inflation since 2003. And as the graph shows, had the formula kept pace with inflation since 2003, it would be $639 per pupil higher today. I would also note that AMSD has long advocated for actually tying the formula, the education formula, directly to inflation, and that would still be our preference. But we think as you move forward that at the very least you should consider restoring inflation to the expenditure side of the budget forecast so that you as policymakers would at least have an understanding when you get that forecast of what the budget situation looks like, assuming inflation was included in things like the general education formula. It does not obligate the legislature to fund it at that level. It just tells you what the budget picture looks like if you funded it at that level. It's a very challenging. The current budgeting system does not work real well for school districts, quite frankly. Every year during the session, right about February or March, I will start to get calls from superintendents, from school business officials, and they'll say, what do you think? What should I plug in? Do you think the formula is going to go up by 1%, 1.5%, 2%? And I have no idea, obviously. I mean, I can take a guess, but it all depends on what happens at the Capitol. But those decisions have major ramifications because if a superintendent and their business office, they plug in 1% maybe on the formula, then that's probably going to mean they're going to be making some reductions because that's probably going to be, you know, less than inflation. And so state law requires notices then to go out in the spring to any school staff. They may have to be laid off as a result of that. So then we get a flurry of layoff notices that go out to school staff. And then if in the end the legislature approves something higher than they assumed, then of course many of those staff will hopefully be called back. But So that's just kind of the environment that your schools are operating in right now. And so when I saw what was on your schedule today, Mr. Chairman, that was why I put the request in, just to raise this issue with all of you and give you something for consideration as you move forward in these discussions. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Representative Carlson.
I'm just curious, being that I'm one and probably everybody at the table here gets that same question, what do we think is going to happen? How do you answer the question when the superintendent calls you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I play it pretty conservative because, it's quite a disaster if you overestimate what you're going to get. And because then, of course, if you don't send off those layoff notices, then the school district is locked in to that staffing level and can have pretty dire consequences on the school budget then.
Yeah, and I typically say be cautious as well.
Mm.
We're probably on the same page because nobody can really predict what the outcome is going to be. That's why I was picking your brain how you handled the question. Right. Thank you.
Representative Rumbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Grunquist, so looking at the dotted line here, which is what the legislature approved, right, those expenditures, 2009 to 2011 was another recession. To me, that explains the flat line. From that time period. And I would not have guessed that inflation continued to go up at the rate you're showing. To me, that makes no sense. But, perhaps you can explain it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Runbeck, so the inflation factor used here is the Consumer Price Index, which, thank you, that's another point I should have made. So we actually believe this is a pretty conservative inflationary estimate. And it is the inflation figures that are provided by the Department of Education through the state of Minnesota. So it's the inflation factors that the state agencies use.
Mr. Chair, that brings, I guess, a question. There are, I think, different people, different agencies that use different levels of inflation, perhaps. I don't know how standardized those are or if there's an official one.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's from the agencies, then I'm not sure is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rumbach, yes, these are figures from the Minnesota Department of Education. And I'm not sure which.
The black line.
The inflationary factor.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I guess to me then that's, I question whether that's authoritative, frankly.
But any further questions, members? Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Grunquist, what would the dollars actually be to the state budget? You've got $639 difference. Do you know, just for the final year, 2021, how much additional dollars would that be out of the general fund?
Mr. Grunquist.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kosnick, I don't have an exact dollar figure, but a rough estimate, it's generally a dollar on the formula is about $1 million, so roughly $639 million is what would be needed to catch up.
Okay. Mr. Kosnick, Representative Kosnick, sorry.
Thank you. No, that's fine. Thanks for the answer.
All right. Any further? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to follow up on Representative Runbeck's question, just maybe ask Mr. Grunquist if he can dive into that inflation issue a little bit and maybe get back to some of us. Mr. Chair, have been sharing with constituents and others that, in fact, that education, state funding for education really has been so much lower than it used to be when you adjust for inflation. And I understand Representative Runbeck's concern. So I feel like we really need to nail that down. But then once we do, we really need to address this concern. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Congressman.
I'm sure we'll get the information back to you. And we'll also get the presentation done by MMB. We'll get that to you, too. So it's a little difficult to read on the screen. We'll get it to you. Representative Rock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm an interloper in your committee today, and I appreciate you allowing me to speak. Hello, nice to see you. With that question, if we're getting data about the inflation number, it does say adjusted for pupil weight change and inflation. So if you could clarify what adjusted for pupil weight change also means. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Robbins. Yeah, so there have been some changes to the education funding formula over the years. A couple of them have been changing the weighting of the pupil units. And so this is just, it's changing, it's making that reflection so you have an apples to apples comparison. So you have a consistent comparison.
Representative Robbins.
Right.
excuse me, Mr. Chair, thank you, as they adjust the formula over time?
Mr. Grunquist.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Robbins, yes. For example, high school secondary students used to be weighted higher. I'm struggling with how to explain this. And the legislature made some changes to that. Different grades were weighted at different levels. And so when you do a comparison, you want to make sure you're comparing apples to apples and not apples to oranges. And so this graph has made that adjustment.
President Robbins, these hearings are open to the entire House, so we welcome you to come back, and we'll have as many members as we can fit into the room. So thank you. Any other questions? Then, members, I think we're done. And Representative McDonald.
Yeah, Chair Pelosi, I do have a question just regarding the committee, and perhaps I presume you talked about it in the first meeting hearing that I was not able to attend. But what is your goal with our committee of reform? I really appreciated the packet that you passed out on the definition of reform and some of the other data in there. What do you hope to accomplish and provide to the legislature in the next session?
Representative, now these hearings started actually prior to session. There were two hearings when we were making the transition in December, and the speaker had requested that a committee, subcommittee of rules be formed to take a look at refinements, and this session again proved we could refine our process perhaps a little bit more. I'm not exactly sure what's going to come out of this, but I expect there'll be two suggestions. One will be rules changes of some kind, and I'm not sure what they will be. Representative Kosnick has already alluded to one that might happen as a result of the special session. There may also be some negotiations with both the governor and the Senate on creating a process that leads to a conclusion of session on time and an agreement that would be made that might change both rules and perhaps even state law. That's why we've had the discussion on the budget. How can we better refine the budget so we can handle the budget within the constitutional deadline? And that seems to be the driver that most of the special sessions come from. So I'm not sure what will happen quite yet, but we're going to keep having hearings, and we will have the speaker also at one of the hearings at least. So, and leadership of the Republican caucus, too, or caucuses, I should say.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Carl.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, a quick follow-up, because that our previous meeting, I raised the question and actually used a model that you chaired earlier. Some of what ultimately could be talked about is going to take changes in the joint rules.
Yes.
And maybe that could be an agenda item at some point, how some of this interacts with the joint rules. But I also stress the importance of perhaps getting to some level the Senate engaged with what we're doing, and that's where you did a very good job with former Senator Murphy when you chaired a committee dealing with mandates in higher education. He became very much a part of the process, which helped greatly to bring about the change with coordination with the other body. So I would only mention that again. I think it's important that we not operate in total isolation because of the change in process that would involve the other body.
Representative Carlson, two senators did approach me about participating in this. They've been invited. I understand conflicts exist. One is a member of the majority and one is a member of the majority in the Senate. And that's why I alluded to the fact negotiations with the Senate. Joint rules would also have to be a discussion in this. And I'm hopeful that we can come to some type of an agreement here that would facilitate changes in the joint rules that would allow us to complete our work on time. So we're hopeful that we can work with the Senate.
Yeah, thank you.
With that, then meeting is adjourned. Thank you, members.